Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back here on the program Dr. Robert Bochak. He's a pediatrician and has been with us monthly for a long time now to be a resource for you, for people to ask questions about children's health. It can be, well, just about anything that you could imagine asking a pediatrician. And in the past, we've talked about lots of different things, certainly illness kind of issues, but we've also talked about stuff and development stuff, all of the stuff about routine vaccinations, sports injuries, picky eaters, people, you know, kids that didn't want to go to sleep or having trouble sleeping, you know, all that kind of stuff. And certainly any of that's open here on the program. Whatever kind of questions and concerns that you might have in regards to your kids or the kids in your life, well, you can certainly call in here and talk with the doctor. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it's a long-distance call, you can use that number, and we will pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. And locally here, 333-9455. Well, thanks very much.
Well, good morning. It's good to be here.
Something that now just occurs off the top of my head. I know this is something that I know we've talked about before, but there's been a lot of concern about kids and whether, you know, their nutritional needs are being met in a positive sort of way. And there is concern about kids being overweight, which may indeed also have something to do with not being active as we would like, and that leading to all kinds of problems. I'm just thinking about the other day, results of a study were released where they were taking a look at sugary soft drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question was, you know, is there something we can do in a diet of a child or adolescent? Just one really simple thing that could yield significant results. And what they found was, if they did nothing else but look at drinks that kids were drinking, and it could be certainly be a carbonated soda, because that's got a lot of sugar. But then there are also other things that they're drinking that might seem on the face of them to be pretty good, fruit juices and stuff like that also have a lot of sugar. And they just said, okay, well, if we take that out, we don't do anything else, we take that out, suddenly we find a significant weight loss. I mean, not huge,
yeah,
but it actually was in doing that one thing, taking out Cokes and Pepsis and you know, whatever else, highly sugar-loaded drinks, we actually get a result. And that seemed encouraging in the sense that then that's also something that you can say to kids. It's saying, look, we're not telling you have to change your entire life. But one thing, now, and I suppose for some kids, that might be a big deal if you say to them, okay, well, you know, that stuff, you can't have that anymore. No more Mountain Dew, no more whatever. But that I think a lot of people were surprised that by doing that one sort of simple thing, you could actually see a significant result from that.
Yeah. I don't remember how many calories there are, non-nutritional calories in a soft drink, but there's a bunch. And I think last month I talked about my cranberry fruit drink that I like so well, and found that there was cranberry juice in it, which is good. And there was apple juice in there because I guess you got to dilute it with something, because I guess cranberry juice is probably kind of bitter. And then there was this high fructose corn syrup in there, and you say, what in the world is that doing in there? So, yeah. So a lot of these juices, I guess you can, or fruit drinks, you can equate with the empty calories, the non-nutritional calories of a soft drink, a carbonated soft drink. And that's true. The other thing that disturbed, I'm just reading in the journal, they did surveys of parents, and parents don't recognize that their kids are overweight.
Hmm.
And they showed these people pictures, line drawings of fat kids, less fat kids, down to almost emaciated kids, and the parents almost always picked the wrong body type for them. If their child was overweight by BMI and all kinds of other things, the parents picked a more pleasing silhouette for their child than what their child actually represented. So I think part of the problem is, yeah, don't have this stuff in the house. You don't have to tell the kid you can't have soft drinks. Just don't buy it. Just don't have it in the house. But then again, I think parents have to be honest and say, you know what? My kid's getting a little more weight on them than I like. And I think what parents have to do is maybe after the shower, look at themselves in the mirror, because we do know that obesity tends to be hereditary. Well, is it hereditary or is it nurturing? I don't know, but yeah. But if kids have an overweight mother, their chances of being overweight are somewhere in the 80 to 90% range. And if the kids have both overweight parents, they don't have a chance. They don't have a snowball's chance, so to speak, of being normal weight. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to be honest. And then the grocery shopper has the responsibility of, I'm not going to buy potato chips anymore. And I'm not going to buy soft drinks anymore. And, yeah, I'm going to control what's available in the house. And if it's not there, well, yeah, they can go out with their quarter and or 50 cents or whatever, or a dollar, I guess, now for a can of soft drink and get it. But chances are they'll do that, but they're going to still get less calories in. So, since it's not at home, it's not readily available. And I think we're hearing about a lot of schools getting, yeah, they used to make money off these pop machines, and they're going to not make that money, but they are for the health of the kids in the school, taking these pop machines out of the schools and replacing with juice machines or milk machines or iced tea machines or whatever they're replacing them with.
Although if the iced tea has sugar in it, there you kind of well, yeah. And I think that's just what we would, and anybody nutritionist or health folks would encourage people to do is read the label.
Yes,
and I think now more and more people are doing it. They may do it in a kind of a casual way, but I think that people are reading the label and they are starting to get interested in things like how many calories from fat in this thing. Is there a lot of salt in there? Is there a lot of sugar in there? Is there trans fats in there? And I think that those are all things that people are actually starting to think about and try to learn about and try to actually pay attention to. So that and that's all to the good.
And this is a real problem because I volunteer at a local hospital, and the wheelchairs they're purchasing now have a weight requirement. They will handle somebody up to 450 pounds. Whereas, the wheelchair of old held a average-sized person, but now we are, the hospitals are much more cognizant of, we got some really huge people here that we have to transport around.
And I guess another thing is if parents are, they have this question in their mind about, is my child, is he or she at a healthy weight or what is considered to be a healthy weight? Now, at least if people have internet access, it's pretty easy. There are a lot of places that they have calculators that will figure out the BMI, which the body mass index, which is just basically a calculation that's based on your height and your weight. Mm-hmm. And you take those two things and they crunch those numbers and then they give you a number.
Yeah.
And then that gives you a number that says, okay, this is considered to be under, this is considered to be over, this is considered to be a good middle range, and that makes it if you have access to that kind of thing, that makes it pretty easy to figure out, or easier than to figure out if you were going to try to do that yourself, because there we did in the old days. I think it was just pretty much just based on height and weight.
Yeah.
And and we said, okay, for a person of this height, the weight should be in this range, and I guess now that the BMI seems to be a little bit, maybe it does a better job of figuring out what's what.
And again, why are we talking about this stuff? Why are we worried about this stuff? It's for long-term health. It's about trying to prevent diabetes. It's about trying to prevent hypertension. It's about trying to prevent heart disease in the future. And it's just not to. It's just not about looks and appearance.
Our phone lines here are open if people have questions. This is the day of the month that we set aside to try to give you a chance to ask questions about children's health, just about anything that could be on your mind. You call in, talk with our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He's a clinical assistant professor at the U of I. And we're wide open, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, you said you thought you might be interested in talking a little bit about grandparents.
Maybe we can get a little bit more audience response if we talk about the problems and the perils, the problems, the blessings, the joys, the curses of grandparenting, because I think the role of grandparents has changed. It used to be, what did the grandparent do? They came over, they brought the child a gift, they zipped them up, they took them out for Dairy Queen or something like that, and when they were thoroughly zipped up, they went back home again. But now it's, I think, to a great deal changed. There's a lot of grandparents who are providing daycare for the kids. So yeah. They're surrogate parents for much of the week, too. And, yeah, I'd like to hear from people out there. How do you deal with the dual role of Monday through Friday being a surrogate parent, and then Saturday and Sunday revert to being a grandparent? Or how do you leave your role of the overindulgent grandparent and become Monday through Friday the surrogate parent? Yeah. I think it's hard. I think there's a lot of these people that are, a lot of these grandparents are walking a kind of a tightrope.
Well, we have a couple of callers here. I'm not sure what is on these folks' minds, but as I said before, questions, whatever questions, children's health questions are welcome. Anything that you could imagine discussing with a pediatrician, that's a fair game on the show. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And the first caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. I was wondering what the long-term effects of food coloring are on children, or is there any documentation in literature? Because food, I mean, they add so many colorings into it just to make it more attractive for the children. So I was wondering if there, you know, does it have adverse effects on their liver or anything of that sort?
Not that I know of. And I guess it's pretty much not that I know of. Certainly some kids are allergic to food coloring. My son had trouble with red food coloring, and every time you go to a Valentine party, of course the cupcakes were designed with little red hearts on them, and he'd come back with a ear. In his case, it happened to be an ear that stuck out. But as far as behavioral things, there was the Feingold diet that tried to talk about attention, hyperactivity and food coloring, and that turned to be, well, there's still some people that hold to it, but I think for the most part they've not been able to demonstrate that food coloring has a behavioral effect, and I'm not aware of any data at all to suggest that food coloring would have a long-term effect on any organ system, the heart, the liver, the kidneys, anything like that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right. Thanks for the call. To Urbana next. This is line number two. Hello.
You invited calls from grandparents.
Yes.
I'm a grandparent, but my grandkids live quite a distance away, and they're coming for a visit with their parents next week. And so I was looking up some ideas because, you know, I don't see them very often, and it's a little hard to know what sorts of things to have in mind. And I dug up in my stash of books from when my kids were little a book that I bought, but I don't remember ever reading it. And it's got some great ideas in it, and I wanted to recommend it. It's called The Quality Time Almanac, and I checked on Amazon.com, and it is in print.
Okay.
It's by S. Adams Sullivan. And it has both activities and general strategies for dealing with kids. And this father who's writing this book, among other things, as I was reading this last night, he's talking about sibling rivalry and kids fighting. And this was a major challenge. It was a bane of my parenting experience with sibling rivalry. And it was really hard to find good ideas. He has one idea that his kids came up with. They were noticing, they had friends who had terrible sibling rivalry and wanted his kids to take sides, and they thought this was terrible, the amount of animosity between their two friends. And so the two kids came up with the idea that they said, well, you know, it's natural for brothers to fight some, but we're only going to do it on Tuesday afternoons from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And in the meantime, we're going to write down, and they were old enough apparently to write this down, but I suppose if they're younger, the parents could write it down. They were going to write down their annoyances and their lists of crimes against each other. And then when Thursday afternoon came came around, they apparently read their lists and just giggled and called each other's names and just did it for 2 hours and then thought it was terribly funny. And apparently then after, they did that for a couple of Thursdays, and then they kind of forgot about it. They had sort of established this truth and a better perspective. And once in a while, when they would get disgruntled, the parents would remind them that they were going to save these things until Thursday afternoon. I just thought that was a really creative idea.
That's neat.
Never would have occurred to me. And it's got a whole bunch of other things. Some fun stuff, like having a Viking ship in the bathtub and setting it on fire.
Ooh, okay.
Oh, don't do this without parental supervision. Yes.
Right. No, this is something you'd have to do, but it never would have occurred to me. Paper doesn't burn when it's in contact with water. So if you put a piece of typing paper on in the bathtub and you put a couple of crumpled sheets of newspaper on top of that and set the newspaper on fire, you can pretend that this is a longboat going off to.
Okay.
Anyway, so it's got a whole range of ideas. That's a more extreme one, but it talks about safety, and it talks about using that as an example of how you talk with kids about safety and with things that are potentially dangerous. And I think that's an excellent idea for parents to think about. How do you teach kids? When they're ready for it. You wouldn't do this with a 2-year-old. The specific activities that he has, as opposed to the more general stuff he talks about, have clocks that show the amount of time involved, and then also age ranges. So if it's appropriate for 3 to 7-year-olds, it says. If it's not appropriate until they're 5 to 10, it says. And that's right up there in the header. It makes it really easy to sort of and then there's some line drawings. Makes it easy to flip through it and say, oh, that looks interesting, without having to necessarily read it. And he talks about things like reading out loud and how some parents feel or grandparents feel that once a kid can read, that we're denying them practice if we read to them. And talks about why you really should read to them and gives some examples, like reading to them when they're in the bathtub.
Yeah.
Or reading during dinner, all kinds of things that hadn't occurred to me when I was parenting. So I'm hoping to use some of them anyway. There's also two other books, one called The Mother's Almanac that I remember using, and it was written by a female parent. There's one, and this author for the Quality Time Almanac also did one called The Father's Almanac. The Mother's Almanac had in it something called something like the mother's pick-me-up. It was orange juice with deactivated yeast stirred in. I can remember being a young mother with two little kids, and there were just times when I was exhausted, but I couldn't rest because I had to supervise the kids. They were awake, and they were active, and they were too young to be unsupervised. And drinking orange juice with this deactivated yeast, I don't know whether it was psychological or whether my body just knew it was what it needed, and it could taste, the taste buds were telling it, this is coming. Just drinking that, I could feel the energy flow into my body as it went down my throat. I'm sure that wasn't what was actually happening, but it certainly helped somehow give me a little extra boost.
And after the kids are asleep, you can put a little vodka in there.
It didn't mention that, but
deactivated yeast screwdriver. Like
anyway, so there's a couple of resources for folks, and they're large size paperbacks and reasonably priced, and you can probably also get them at your local bookstore. But I do know that they're still in print.
Great.
Thanks. Well,
thank you, and enjoy your grandchildren's visit.
Thanks. Bye.
Another reason why the Viking boat may not work so well anymore is a lot of our bathtubs aren't porcelain over cast iron anymore. They're
made out of some kind of plastic.
Yeah. So I don't know that I'd do that anymore.
I think I got negative concerns about that. But there are probably a lot of other good stuff in there, too. All right. Dr. Bocek is here. Dr. Robert Bocek, he's a pediatrician and is on the program here with us on a regular basis. And we talk about children's health. And your questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign. And this is line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I was actually calling in with a comment about the grandparenting issue.
Mm-hmm.
Happened to live just about three houses away from my mother and my stepfather. We have, my husband and I have three children, a 14-year-old, a 5-year-old, and an 8-month-old. Grandma and grandpa do a good deal of the care for my kids while I'm at work. My
yes.
husband and I both work full-time. While the 14-year-old's obviously in school, the 5-year-old's still in preschool till kindergarten starts, and she does that on a 5-day-a-week basis. My mother does watch the baby, even though she also works. She happens to own her own business, so that's pretty convenient to kind of keep them out of the preschool setting until they're about 2. And I just kind of wanted to comment that what we've found for us anyway is there are some trade-offs that you have to do to make that situation work. And one of those is you do have to trade off that, or we have had to trade off that part of being the grandparent that gets to spoil the kids.
Yeah.
Because it's real confusing for the children. They don't understand the difference between Saturday and Tuesday.
Depending on the age of the kid, yeah.
Right, when they're younger. Now, my 14-year-old, obviously, he's got it down to a science. He knows you can only work me, Mom, on Saturday.
Yes.
But the other thing that we found is a trade-off, and it's something for people to think about, is my husband and I don't have a babysitter in the evenings because Grandma and Grandpa are done. They've done the day. And so we have to make other arrangements where normally, you know, most of my friends with children, my husband and I are in our 30s, they, you know, if they want to go out and have date night or whatever on Tuesday nights, you drop the kids off at Grandma and Grandpa's and you've got 3 or 4 hours that you can go. And we lose that privilege because we've utilized that time elsewhere.
Yeah.
And so there are a couple of things, you know, to think about. Even when you're in close proximity, it happens to work for our family very well. But I've got friends who just think we're insane because it wouldn't work for their family, for the relationship that maybe they have with their parents or what they need from that relationship. So it is kind of a tough situation.
It's a tightrope, yeah. It's, you know, I guess the other thing I haven't, you know, and I bring this up because I haven't seen much in the literature about this, but it's got to be somewhat tough on the kids too, because you know what? There are some things as a child I could maybe I'll confide in Grandma and Grandpa, but when Grandma and Grandpa are my surrogate parent from Monday through Friday, has that changed the relationship, and has it changed the relationship that I have with Grandma and Grandpa, and utilize them less or differently?
Yeah. Now, on the plus side of it, though, my grandmother actually lived across the street from me, obviously very close family. My grandma lived across the street from me when my 14-year-old was very small, and so he went over there for 2 or 3 hours a day every day, even though at the time I did in-home daycare. And what we kind of have gotten from that relationship and then having a relationship with Grandma and Grandpa on a regular basis is, number one, they've got a lot more patience as far as showing them how to do things. My son works very well with tools because my stepfather still works and teaches him how to, you know, how to use the backhoe and the tools and things like
that. Okay, neat.
But also, family history gets passed down on kind of a one-to-one. It's not, my grandma told my mom told me, I told them. They experienced it. My 14-year-old, I manage a senior citizens apartment complex. My 14-year-old comes out, and with elderly people, he is absolutely amazing because he spent time with his great-grandmother, who was elderly. And so it's not a forced relationship. It's something he's comfortable with. And so there is a huge amount of education for other generations.
Yes.
That goes on, I think, on a more honest basis. When you only see grandma for a week a year, grandma, you know, rests up for it and she's ready for it and she feels good for that whole week and she wouldn't admit to not feeling well because it's the only week she has with you. Whereas on an everyday basis, there are some realities to getting older and
yes.
living life as an older person that I think we kind of shelter young people from sometimes, and it makes getting older and it makes that period in life seem so frightening. As you get older, you know, the older
yeah.
you get, the bigger juggernaut that becomes. So I do think it lends itself a bit to just a bit of honesty about, you know, they're still very active, vibrant, capable people, and they know a heck of a lot more than the rest of us do, and so I think there's some benefits as well.
I think, yeah. The other thing is, I think it makes history, what they read in school, at least 20th century history, depending on how old the grandparents are, alive, real.
Sure.
World War II becomes real.
My grandpa had me convinced he knew Pocahontas, so, you know.
Okay. Well, yeah. And grandpas are allowed to,
embroider upon the truth.
Yes.
But thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
All right. Bye.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Again, this is our monthly show on children's health. Dr. Robert Bocek is here. He's a pediatrician, and he is with us frequently on a regular basis to talk about children's health. And he just said it would be interesting to hear people talk a little bit about the experience of grandparenting, but also want to make sure that other folks who are listening know that this is a general opportunity to ask child health
Anything's
questions.
Welcome.
Anything's welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we have another caller on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a health question.
Yes.
I read something recently. I don't know if y'all covered this at the beginning, because I tuned in a little later. But I heard about the younger that kids are exposed to antibiotics, I guess when they're within a year old, that they have a higher incidence of asthma. And this was covered, I think it was, I had WGN on the background. I didn't hear the whole story. So that I guess the younger they are, the more antibiotics are exposed to, they have seen a higher incidence of asthma in those kids. And I didn't know if you had information on that.
No, I don't. I guess it makes sense because, in a way, the immune system is still being primed up in that. And in a way, it makes sense. I haven't seen any data published in the pediatric literature yet, and I'm sure it will pretty soon. But we do know that, the younger kids – well, let me take it to foods. The younger kids are exposed to foods, the more likely they are to be allergic to some of them if there's the tendency in the family. What's going on with asthma in the world? I don't know. It seems to be increasing, and I don't think anybody really knows for sure what's going on. Is it the pollution in the environment? Maybe, maybe not. But we don't know why asthma is increasing in the world, and I wish I could better answer your question. I can't, except that I think the words out there, we are overusing and abusing antibiotics. We are asking them to do things they cannot do. They are medications. They do have their positive effects. They will have their side effects, their negative effects. And let's be careful when we use them. And maybe what you're talking about is, another reason to be careful and not throw antibiotics around when we aren't pretty sure we need to use them.
Right. Well, my son was exposed to them early on for a long time because of a ton of ear infections, and he also had cellulitis.
Okay.
So he was required to have them at a young age.
Yeah.
I don't think they threw him around in those instances. So now my concern is, okay, he's almost two. Should I be watching for certain symptoms? And when does asthma tend to? Because my sister had asthma early on as a child, and she outgrew it to some extent, but even now requires an inhaler when she has, extra sports activity or something, and she's over 40. So so it's somewhat in the family, and to some extent none of us ever got it. So I wondered if there's something to watch for and be cognizant of as he develops.
I think I'd be inclined to say if he's two and has not had a wheezing episode yet.
He has.
He has.
He's had a couple, but it's never, it's usually been taken care of pretty quickly with steroids.
You know what? I still feel good. If he's two and has had a couple, he may have more, but I think he's not going to be a troublesome asthmatic.
Okay.
I feel good about his prognosis.
Okay, good. Well, that's good to hear.
And also, what are the circumstances of his other wheezing episodes? Was it almost always associated with a respiratory illness, a cold?
Yes.
A good snotty nose? Yeah.
Yep.
I would odds are that after age 5, he will probably, he may at worst be like his aunt, occasionally having trouble.
Okay. Okay, but just otherwise, if he has more occurrences of the wheezing, then that could be a good sign that he might have a little bit more trouble with asthma. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and the asthma is diagnosed with a test or
no.
just symptoms?
It's a clinical diagnosis.
Okay.
This child has a cough mainly at night, and maybe, especially the more wound up they get, they begin to wheeze.
Okay.
And you have an audible wheeze.
Okay, so that would be like not associated with a cold or anything.
Yeah. Most asthma in young children is triggered by viral infections.
Okay.
So as they get older, they have less of these upper respiratory infections. They have less triggers. And
okay.
That may be why they outgrow it, quote unquote.
I see. Okay. Okay. Now that makes sense.
But,
okay, well, good. Okay.
Yeah, but wheezing in young children is much, much more common than wheezing in school-age children and on up to adulthood.
Okay. Okay. I understand. Okay, well, good. Well, thanks for your help.
You're welcome.
Well, thanks for the call. So now I am moved to ask you about when you say wheezing, what does that mean exactly?
Okay. Basically, they're having trouble breathing.
Uh-huh.
And what they get is they get airway constriction, so they have trouble getting the air out, so you hear the audible wheeze.
Oh, okay. So that simply is just a matter of if you've heard it before, you've heard it enough.
Yeah.
You just know a sound that they make when they breathe. You'd say, okay, that's it.
Yeah. Although wheezing again is relatively late in the course of this inflammatory thing going on in the lungs. So usually, what you notice at first is a lot of coughing, especially at nocturnal coughing, nighttime coughing. And you may notice that they play a little bit less because they're having a little trouble breathing. So with exertion, they just don't have the lung reserved there. And then ultimately the wheezing will come on. And ultimately, if the wheezing is severe enough, you won't hear any wheezing anymore because they aren't moving any air anymore. So you don't hear the wheezing. But it's usually an expiratory sound first.
Okay.
The wheeze, if you hear it, it'll be an expiratory wheeze.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just go back for a second to the use of antibiotics question, something that has been now discussed. We talked about it. It's been in the media, this concern that maybe we're giving too many antibiotics, and that if you do that, what you're doing is you're actually creating a laboratory for creating resistant strains, and then you could really be in trouble if you have suddenly find out that your antibiotics that have been working for a long time don't work anymore. And that while we are trying to sensitize parents to this so that they don't march into the doctor's office and say, this child must have it. And also the same thing for doctors not to overprescribe.
Yes.
And at the same time, though, there still seems to be concern that there's too much. For example, here I'm just looking at I'm on WebMD and I'm looking at a study from just last fall that apparently someone went out and was looking at kids who turn up at doctor's offices with sore throats. And the fact that apparently a lot of doctors are just maybe assuming that the kids have strep and that they're giving them antibiotics. And in fact, a significant number of those kids don't have strep. And so that there would be, there's no point in giving antibiotics.
Yeah.
So that makes me wonder, again, how much of this is driven by parents who have a sick child and honestly want the doctor to make them well. So they're thinking, well, come on, let's have some medication. And a doctor may be responding to that, or just simply a doctor, maybe that the feeling is that it is strep, or you just want to make, you want to make sure. I mean, if it is, you want to treat it, you do a culture, it's going to take you some time to figure out that's what it is. And so who knows how long it'll be before you start the kid on antibiotics. So maybe you think, well, let's just give it. And that there still seems to be some education done on the doctor's point of view to remind them. Now remember, we know you know this, but, remember, you want to be careful with these things. You shouldn't just be handing them out unless you really know that that's you got something that really will treat.
Yeah. Because, you know, maybe 10% of the sore throats are strep. So the other 90% are probably a virus. There may be another bacteria, but it's another bacteria. Why do we care about strep throat? Because we care about rheumatic fever, and strep throat can lead to rheumatic fever. And that's why we, and these other sore throats, number one, penicillin won't fix them. Number two, they don't lead to anything anyway. So just let them go. So for, yeah, extra 10, 50, for $10 or $15, we can do a rapid strep test and or a throat culture. If we do a throat culture, it's going to take maybe 24, 48 hours to get them started on an antibiotic. And the antibiotic probably doesn't shorten the course of the sore throat. It probably doesn't make them better faster. Mm-hmm. But it will prevent the rheumatic fever, and that's what we wanted. That's why we treat group A beta hemolytic strep throat, to prevent rheumatic fever, not to make the sore throat go away, because it probably doesn't work that way. So we've got probably from the time they start the sore throat, we've got 30 days to start the antibiotics. And they're going to be well by then, but we've got 30 days and we've still prevented the rheumatic fever. So, I mean, waiting 24 hours or 48 hours for a throat culture is, yeah, not doing anything bad to the patient at all. It's not, yeah, it's not making him sick longer. It's not putting him at any increased risk for strep throat. So let's treat what we know. Let's use the antibiotics properly. Yeah.
Well, in the meantime, and again, I think about how recently there seemed to be, there's a study for everything, isn't there? But recently there have been some studies that show that a lot of the over-the-counter products that are designed to treat symptoms of cough and cold maybe don't work very well.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably most of them, yeah.
Yeah. So, say you got sore throat. I mean, what really is the best that you, if the best you can do is to try to make the kid comfortable, you know, what have you got?
Probably a little something to reduce the fever, because usually strep throat has fever. They make gargles that usually don't work very well, the chloroseptics and that sort of thing, because if you can get it back on your tonsils, you're probably going to drown.
Yeah.
You can't get back that far. So basically what I'm saying, you know what, you get strep throat, you're probably going to be miserable for 3 days. So you do the best you can. You take some ibuprofen or acetaminophen and, you drink cold liquids and try and numb things down that way.
Yeah. Okay. And that's probably about the best you can do, just keep them as comfortable as you can.
Yeah.
Do something to try to distract them and just, you got to just wait it out.
Yeah. Read books to them, like that earlier caller talked
about. Oh, good point. Okay. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bocek, and we're inviting your questions about children's health and whatever's on your mind, the kind of things that you can imagine talking about with a pediatrician. We can do that. Health, development, wellness, behavior, any of that kind of stuff. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good. Anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455.
You know, probably 3 million years ago, there were penicillin-resistant bacteria. Because bacteria divide every X number of finite number of minutes, and their genetic code gets messed up sometimes in these divisions. And there is probably a penicillin-resistant bacteria eons, millennia before there was penicillin, but there weren't any penicillin to select these particular bacteria out. So they just disappeared again and then resurged again. And, you know, one came up, but there was no penicillin out there to select them. So, and I think it's just been in the last few decades where we've had penicillin and, well, the sulfas first, then the penicillins, and then we messed with the penicillins and got more. So we've got more and more bugs that are resistant to multiple antibiotics. And apparently these bacteria are smart. They talk to one another. They share information through sharing genetic material. So they let their friends know that this antibiotic's out there. Here's how to be resistant to it.
Pretty smart. All right. Let's talk with some other folks here. Champaign, wait a minute. Let me see. What am I doing here? How about Edwardsport, Indiana? Let's do that. Line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I just had a comment about asthma. I was raised in Florida, and my brother and I had asthma. And I'm 46 years old, so this was several years ago. But the doctor told my dad to take us to the beach, and we would play duck, and we would hold our breath underwater as long as we could. And that he said that would increase our lung capacity and help us to breathe better. And we outgrew it. I don't know if that helped it or not. I was wondering what you thought about that.
Yeah, I don't know if that helped it or not either. But certainly, maybe it did. I haven't seen any good data on that. But certainly what a lot of asthmatics have trouble with exertion when they run. When they play basketball, when they do exertional sports like that, they may have trouble. It may kick their asthma up a little bit. So if your child does have asthma, has trouble with exertion, we've talked about nutrition. We talked about how important physical activity is. Swimming is an activity that's, for some reason, and I think it's still unknown, almost all asthmatics will tolerate without getting into exertional asthma.
Okay, I was just wondering about that, whether it really worked or we just outgrew it, or
I suspect for the most part you just outgrew it.
Okay.
Because most asthmatics do. Well, I'm not supposed to say they outgrow it because it never disappears. You once an asthmatic, always an asthmatic. Or yeah, we can always make you wheeze, but we have to do stranger and stranger challenges to make you wheeze.
And I was also wondering about. You know, all the air fresheners and candles and all that mm-hmm. that we use in our houses nowadays and things like that. I wonder if that doesn't add to some of the breathing problems that kids have sometimes.
You know, I think it sure could, because we sure know that some asthmatics have a lot of trouble with fragrances. And I think what we've talked, yeah, most of the literature talks about perfumes and that, fragrances we rub on rather than, you know, why does our dishwashing detergent have to smell like pine or flower or something like that? Why can't it just be odorless? And we sure do, you know, every product we use has an odor to it, and then we put the air fresheners in to cover up all these multiple other odors, and maybe we ought to, yeah, just go odorless for as much as possible.
I know I'm allergic. I have asthma anymore, but I have a low tolerance for a lot of smells.
Mm-hmm. Why? What do you mean?
It makes me feel uncomfortable, and my I don't want to breathe it in.
Okay.
A lot of, you know, especially a lot of perfumes.
Okay. Does it give you any sensation? Do you feel a tightness in your chest? Do you feel like somebody's leaning on your chest?
Yes, a little bit.
Okay. That's asthma.
Okay.
That's probably a symptom of asthma, where you're just getting that tight, constrictive feeling in your chest, like your shirt's too tight or something
right.
like that.
But it seems like once I get away from that smell,
absolutely,
then I'm okay.
Yeah, you've.
So I don't know if I'm allergic to it or I just don't like it, or you know.
No, it's probably not an allergy, but it is on the trigger list. Fragrances can be on the trigger list, and it's probably not an IgE. Allergy type things, but for some reason, yeah, fragrances can trigger asthma in some people.
I just think that sometimes it's overkill.
we don't like an odorless environment, do we?
No, nowhere.
Well, thanks for the call.
Well, thank you.
We appreciate it. Let us continue. Let's go to a caller here in Champaign. This is line 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a 12-year-old daughter, and she is apparently developing differently in her chest area. One breast is smaller than the other breast, and it's actually noticeable now. And I was wondering if that was normal or if we should get that looked at.
She has breasts on both sides, though. She is developing on both sides.
She is developing on both sides, but one is substantially larger than the other one.
Okay. At this time, at age 12, I think I would watch it, but I think I'm not overly concerned about it yet. Hopefully, the other side will catch up.
Okay.
And she will be approximately symmetrical. I am told that no woman is perfectly symmetrical. But certainly, we want to, yeah, symmetrical enough that the appearance is not, yeah.
Obvious.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Great. Well, that's good to know then. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Thank you for the call. We got something a call here off the air, someone who wanted to have you talk a little bit about bedwetting. And the question here is, what do you do when you have a child where it's still happening at age 6 or 7? And the one thing that I can't tell you that you might want to know is, are we talking about a boy or a girl?
Sure.
So I can't tell you that. But maybe you could talk a little bit generally about that.
Actually, I guess I don't care if they're a boy or
a girl.
Oh,
it doesn't
matter. But no, but bedwetting problems are much more common in boys. Age 6 or 7, we'd still say something like 15% of kids are bedwetting. And we'd still say, don't do anything. Perhaps at any age, we'd say, don't do anything, because we can't do anything. The medications certainly don't work. Well, that's not true. The medications certainly do work. But the medications out there, the day you stop them is the day they start wetting the bed again.
Mm-hmm.
But under age 6 or 7, bedwetting is considered normal, and we recommend no action at all.
Oh, okay. So at what point then do you start worrying?
After 7 or 8, then what we usually recommend is the so-called wet alarm system or the bell buzzer system. It's a little battery-operated thing that clips to the front of their pajamas, and the theory is that when their bladder is full, something's not being there's a delay in a transmission system up to the brain that says, hey, wake up, take me to the potty. And what this bell wet alarm does is it clips to the front of the pajamas, and the minute the first drop of urine hits the little snap, a contact is made, a loud alarm goes off, wakes the child up. And then they can decide, all right, bladder, you're really not that full. Shut up. I'm going back to sleep. Or, okay, you are that full. I'm going to the,
yeah.
Okay. We're going to go void and take care of that. And I guess that's enuresis in a nutshell.
All right. Well, we are getting closer to the end. If someone wants to call real quick, they can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm just also thinking about the previous caller talking about her experience with perfumes and the fact that I think that's one of the things that we know can be, for people who have reactive airways, that's one of the things that can trigger that sensation. It may not get really bad, but something that you would notice, and that there are a list of standard things. Tobacco smoke gets some people.
Yes.
Cold air just gets some people.
Hot air can, humid.
Yeah, a lot of it can. Yeah. It can be a lot of different sorts of things, right?
Yes.
What besides the? I mean, we've sort of named the big ones. Or are there some other things?
An infection is still a big trigger, especially the younger the child. The younger the child, the more likely an upper respiratory infection, a common cold, not a bad infection, not pneumonia or anything like that, just a cold will trigger it,
mm-hmm.
especially under age 5.
Something I had just been thinking about lately is that, we talked about how kind of about scents and about air fresheners. There's a product that I now have seen fairly heavily promoted that's being sold as a air sterilizer or something like that. And I've taken a look at this thing, and apparently, as I understand from reading the label, what it is it's literally it's aerosolized alcohol. It has alcohol in it that's in a spray form and with some scent. At least I know that's one of the things that's on the label. And I guess the idea is if there's bacteria or something like that in the air, that if you spray this into the air, it's going to kill it. Or if it falls down, I guess, on a surface, it's going to do that. And I wonder a little bit about particularly whether there is some kind of a problem if you would – with inhaling some of this stuff. I mean, I'm sure that they don't want you really to do that, but I'm not sure how it is you spray this in your room without ending up breathing some of it in, and whether that's a problem or not.
I don't think I'd spend money. The other thing is alcohol evaporates so fast. I wonder how much that alcohol really gets any place, and it just really strikes me as way to make money for this company,
I guess.
But it doesn't strike me as – I don't think you're going to get enough in the air to you're not going to get a coat of alcohol on everything. I can't see that's going to really
Now, it could be that I'm misunderstanding how this product is intended to work. And that's not really the key active ingredient. Mm-hmm. But having looked at it, that's on there, and that and it does sort of actually have a little bit of an alcohol sort of a smell to it. And that's what I thought, that's what it is that it's doing. Now, you know, maybe I'm completely wrong about this, and somebody out there is listening and saying, oh, Dave, you don't know what you're talking about, which wouldn't be the first time.
It doesn't strike me as a good idea.
Yeah. Well, are
is
there
this
other,
a 1-800 number?
No, it's actually it's a thing you can just go down into the grocery store or whatever and buy the thing. Well, now that we're on the subject of something like that, of disinfectant, say even something an old line product like Lysol, been around forever. Do things like that actually work? And are there particular times where you would say, yeah, maybe that would be a good idea?
Yes, they do work, but they don't work on everything. Like they won't. Well, a lot of things, if they land on this tabletop, are going to dry out and die anyway. Some things are going to live there for a long time, and I'm not sure Lysol is going to do some of those things in. So I think, I think there's probably no substitute for soap and water, especially. And if you haven't got soap, water works well. And I think the other thing that is talked about, to a certain extent, is kids who grew up on the farm where there were pigs and chickens and all kinds of other stuff and dirt, and kids who were exposed to germs at an earlier age seem to have less allergies. Their immune system was directed toward infection fighting and bacteria fighting, and it just, the immune system wasn't, I guess, left to do its own thing and create IgE, which is an allergy thing. So we do seem to see less, for some reason, or for this reason, the immune system tie-up, there seems to be less allergies amongst kids raised in a, quote, dirty environment, unquote. Yeah. And that it may be healthier for us to live in a dirty environment.
Okay. Well, go out there and enjoy the dirt.
Eat a worm.
Dr. Robert Bojack, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.